From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, educators at all levels, K through college, face conundrums around the restart of school.
What you're seeing is the limits of planning. They're saying what, that military plans exist until the first shot is fired?
Welcome to the war. Also, how Michigan's sizable Yemeni community found its home.
The actual first Yemeni Americans who came here were ordered to do so by the British ambassador, who was in charge of Yemen at the time. Henry Ford asked for a couple hundred workers.
Joining the American experience, though, was a much longer road, and a new biography of the musician who switched on synths for American ears.
Each note required a different configuration of wires and buttons and switches to get the right pitch and the right timbre and the right frequency and the right attack and the right decay.
Wendy Carlos and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, the composer who put the Moog synthesizer on the map, setting a path for a generation of electronic artists.
Up until the late 1960s, the synthesizer was largely something that you found in a very specialized laboratory at a university. And very often the music that those synthesizers were used to create was very, very abstract. And she wanted to bridge that gap and show people that the synthesizer could make music that was approachable.
That's coming up on today's show in full stereophonic sound. But first, school's back in session this week for many districts in Michigan, including Detroit. If your local district or college or university has not restarted, you may at least be picking up supplies or, in some lucky cases, school supply technology for distance learning. However, it appears the ticker is already in motion for COVID cases associated with Michigan schools. Ron French covers education for Bridge Magazine, and he has been tracking this story. Ron, welcome to Stateside.
It's great to be here.
Let's talk about the higher education map first. Are there colleges and universities in Michigan that have experienced outbreaks already?
There are. As you know, probably, and your listeners know, there have been some high-profile situations like that around the country, University of North Carolina, Notre Dame, but there have been examples here too. Central Michigan University, they started school a couple of weeks ago on a Monday. By Friday, they had 38 cases. 2 weeks after school started, they now have 178 cases that the health department believes is linked directly to students returning to Mount Pleasant. In fact, the cases were so bad there that a few days after it was publicized that there had been an outbreak that was linked to house parties, actually, which is no shock, and they're college students. Eastern Michigan looked at that situation and immediately scrambled to put all their classes online instead of bringing students back. The other example that we're just finding out about today is Adrian College, where there are almost as many students and staff who have tested positive for coronavirus at Adrian College as there have been at Central Michigan, which is 10 times as large. At Adrian College, over 6% of all students and staff have already tested positive 2 weeks into the semester.
How has the administration at Adrian responded to the infection?
They've sent a letter out to students and staff asking students to be careful. They've asked staff to immediately switch when they can to online courses. The small private colleges, April, have a real problem going online and asking students to stay home that your bigger universities, such as the University of Michigan and Michigan State, do not. A lot of these smaller private colleges depend heavily on money they receive from residence halls and cafeterias to survive. If they send their kids home, it's not a for sure thing that all these small colleges in Michigan will survive.
You mentioned that house parties appear to be a factor in a lot of the spread. There was this crazy video of Central Michigan President Robert Davies at a house party with students in mid-August playing cornhole. Was that for real?
Yeah, unfortunately it was. It probably seemed like one of those things that was a good idea at the time and looks horrible. But so it's opening weekend, and I'm sure it'd be very common for a university president to create some spree decor by going to the parties. And he was outside. He had a mask on. He was playing cornhole. But if you look at the video and you look at the photos that were taken of him, you can see almost none of the students are wearing masks. He later apologized for that. In fact, there's a separate video of several police officers playing beer pong at Central Michigan. So it wasn't exactly taken seriously. This was opening weekend at Central, and it was the house parties on that opening weekend that spread coronavirus.
Ron, when you look at the speed of transmission in some of these higher ed spreads, is it consistent with the way that COVID has been spreading in any other community? I guess what I'm asking is, have the universities had any success in the risk mitigation that they were hoping to do?
What you're seeing is the limits of planning. They're just saying that military plans exist until the first shot is fired. I that's pretty much what has happened at universities.
Mm-hmm.
Universities have spent countless hours creating these incredible protocols for safety in dormitories, in classrooms. Some universities have spread their desks farther apart. A lot of them have decided that you have to wear face masks on campus. Some of them have given students the option and staff the option of being completely remote, being online if they want to. But you're dealing with human beings. You're also dealing with human beings who are college age. We've all been college age at some point in our lives. We know that when you're in college, you're very social. And so, as one Central Michigan University professor said, hey, every kid in my classes has worn a mask. They've all been socially distant. They've all been perfect. But we can't control what happens outside class. Students do what students are going to do. They party. They get together in groups. And when they do, they often tend to be not 6 feet apart. They often tend to not have masks on also. And so there's only so much that a university can control. So when you get a large gathering, it's to answer your question, it is consistent in how this spreads to the fact that when you have a lot of people in tight quarters not wearing masks, this is going to spread.
Ron, folks might remember that we spoke with your colleague Robin Erb not too long ago about a story that you two worked on together. There had been, about a dozen outbreaks at schools and universities around the region. And at that point, the state health department wasn't releasing information about where those outbreaks had occurred. Ron, have you learned anything new since then?
Well, we've learned that the state is now putting out a weekly report on outbreaks. And the number of outbreaks in K-12 schools and colleges have increased from 10 last week to 14 this week. We do not know where those outbreaks are. We do not know how many coronavirus cases are in those outbreaks. That information is still not being released. The information that is released is by these crazy pandemic regions that the state has set up that cover, in many cases, 8 to 12 counties and rural areas, or it would include like Oakland, Macomb, Wayne, it's so popular. If you say
it doesn't really tell you anything because it's so broad. Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
Well, how is it that privacy laws that are part of HIPAA extend to institutions in this way?
It doesn't. And that's not what the state is saying. I have to give them a little bit of wiggle room here to the extent that this is new for everybody. They're making this plane up as it's flying, just like all of us are. And the reporting system they have set up, they are getting reports from local health departments and feeding them into the system that I'm sure you and I see every day that shows the number of new coronavirus cases. And as the pandemic has gone on, they've added more information. Well, one of the things they do with the schools is they will list that there's an outbreak, and they will list whether it's in a school. But they don't ask, but the system is not set up to say, oh, really? What school is it in? And so the computer system, the reporting system is just not set up for it yet. They're trying to tweak that system so that more information is being relayed from the local health departments to the state offices, and the state offices will then release it to the public. They're saying that will happen at some point. We're not very satisfied with how quickly they're moving on this. I'm certain parents are not either.
Yeah. What do we know about whether and how COVID is spreading through K-12 schools right now?
Well, we know that there are, according to the state, at least 8 outbreaks in K-12 schools. We don't know where they are. I know that there was one that received some publicity recently at Heartland High School. There were at least 13 confirmed cases and several more probable cases at the high school, and they immediately switched to online learning. But we just know there are outbreaks someplace, and we just don't know where yet.
What does that mean for the planning process and start dates? Do we know if school districts are more or less starting on time or if some have delayed?
I haven't heard anything about schools delaying start dates. Possibly there is, but because there's so much local control on our K-12 school system in the state, it's really hard to keep track of what schools are doing. I can tell you that there was a study done at Michigan State University that found that the majority of students, I think about 80% of students, have the option, at least the option of attending school in person. About 7 in 10 have the option of staying at home. But as far as how schools are reacting, I think most schools are doing a great job of working with local health departments and what the protocols will be once a case occurs in their schools. Most school systems assume that at some point there will be coronavirus cases in their classrooms. Mm.
It sounds like there just aren't a lot of tools out there for parents who may be concerned about the possible hazards of face-to-face instruction.
Well, there's some information about the hazards and the precautions that schools are taking, but information about where there are outbreaks, unfortunately, because of the lack of transparency at the state level currently, parents are left to figure this out on Facebook groups, frankly. That's where most of this information is spreading. And as you and I both know, social media is not always 100% accurate. And obviously, if my Johnny is in third grade at Smith Elementary, I'd like to know if there are coronavirus cases in Smith Elementary. And I think schools generally are going to let parents know, but there's no law that requires them.
Ron French is an education reporter for Bridge, Michigan. Ron, we really appreciate your work. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you so much.
In just a moment, we're going to meet a part of the Arab American community we don't often recognize. That's the 30,000 Yemeni Americans living in Michigan.
The actual first Yemeni Americans who came here were ordered to do so by the British ambassador, who was in charge of Yemen at the time. Henry Ford asked for a couple hundred workers.
Stay tuned. More on that just around the corner on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The origins of Metro Detroit's Yemeni community go back more than 100 years. There are more than 30,000 people living in Michigan right now who trace their family roots back to Yemen. Many of them are in the Hamtramck area. Some are closer to Dearborn. The protests winding through the streets of many Michigan cities have a decidedly different flavor in places with large Arab American communities. That was certainly true in Hamtramck. We wanted to hear a bit more about it, so we're joined now by Brian Stone, English language editor for the Yemeni American News, based in Dearborn. Brian, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
It sounds like the first Yemenis who came to Michigan came for pretty much the same reason a lot of other people came here, to work in the factories. Would you say that's true?
It's true, but with a little bit of unique flavor and spice. The actual first Yemeni Americans who came here were ordered to do so by the British ambassador, who was in charge of Yemen at the time. Henry Ford asked for a couple hundred workers, and he asked the British ambassador to Yemen for it, and they sent the workers over. Those were the first Yemeni Americans to come to Michigan that we know of. Ford was so impressed with their work ethic and just how hard they were working in his factories that he called the ambassador back and said, "I want more." And that's how the journey started.
Yeah, there's an apocryphal story that I know makes the rounds in Yemeni American circles about Henry Ford meeting with a Yemeni sailor, but it sounds like there was a bit more practicality than prose to it at the end of the day.
Yeah, he needed workers for his factories. And I think that what he found is something that I think most people in Dearborn would agree with, that Yemeni American character is one defined by hard work, and just honesty and a real willingness to get things done. And so that's what he discovered. And he really started that migration because of how he felt about those Yemeni workers.
Can you track for us what has happened in the decades since then, how the pattern of Yemeni movement to America has worked out?
For most of the last century, the Yemeni community in and around Dearborn has primarily been sort of like a guest workership, but not quite the same, where a lot of people were coming here, they would work at the factories, and they would get full citizenship, and then their families would get full citizenship. But men were primarily the ones who were here, while many of the women and families stayed in Yemen. Many of them maintained this dual citizenship. It passed on through generations. And there was an increase as there was more civil strife in Yemen throughout the years. You know, so there were some migrations that happened where more and more people were coming here for permanent residency. And the real first explosion sort of happened actually in Hamtramck. What we've seen is that in recent years, with the civil war in Yemen that started a few years ago, what's really happened is that so many Yemeni Americans who were already American citizens, but many of them just living, their extended families were living in Yemen still, they've sort of rubber banded and snapped back over to the United States for safety. And so what, you know, was estimated by some groups to be 4,000 to 5,000 Yemeni Americans in Dearborn has ballooned. And most people think that it's easily between 15,000 and 20,000 Yemenis in Dearborn now, and then a large number making up maybe a third to 40% of Hamtramck. And so these migrations happened in part because people were already citizens and they really valued that U.S. citizenship, but they also kept close ties with Yemen. And so this latest big migration was not like what we've seen with Syrian migrants, where they've had to apply for refugee status and whatnot. Although there are many Yemenis who don't have legal status, or at least don't have citizenship yet, who have got what's called temporary protected status because of the war in Yemen. But the majority of the people who came here were already U.S. citizens.
What's the situation at the moment? I was under the impression that Yemenis were part of the group that was not even allowed into the United States today due to the Trump administration's set of rules inaugurated back in 2016.
Well, this is sort of a mixed bag. So there has been some migration, but it's because many of these people are already U.S. citizens. So it's, and then there's, you know, sort of extended family that's already here and things like that. And so temporary protected status was renewed in the last couple of years. And so that has allowed people who were here who didn't already have citizenship or maybe a green card to stay, at least until things have resolved inside Yemen. But I think what's most likely to happen is we're going to have a more permanent residency for those members over time, and that they'll be eventually gaining citizenship.
Would you say that there's anything that sets Yemeni Americans' lives apart from what some other Arab American Michiganders have found in their lives here?
Yeah. And, you know, this is a great question because the Yemeni community is a distinct community that really deserves to be looked at in its own right. And often umbrella terms like Middle Eastern or Arab American are used, and it really papers over the things that are specific and unique and special about the Yemeni community. And so there are some things that even within the Arab community make the Yemeni community stand out. So one of those things is that there's Yemeni culture and Yemeni food, which is very different from what most people are used to finding at quote-unquote Middle Eastern restaurants in Metro Detroit or Michigan, which actually follow more along the Lebanese style of cuisine. And so Yemeni cuisine has more spices and bigger, bolder flavors. You know, and Yemen is sort of right between the rest of the Middle East and Africa. And it really is a transition point where you can imagine spices from India, spices from Africa, all traveling through. And then the many unique spices and different kinds of foods that come from Yemen, most notably for us as journalists, is coffee. So the word mocha, which is, you know, the word for coffee, comes from the port of Mocha in Yemen. So every journalist in America owes a big thank you to the Yemeni community.
And, no question.
And so it's something where we think about the Arab American community as a whole, but even within the Arab American community, there have been differences over time. The Yemeni community has established its own caucus within the Michigan Democratic Party, separate from the Arab American caucus, because they wanted to advance their own unique interests and ideas. And, you know, the character of the community is a little bit different because some of the different Arab communities aren't always as accepting of Yemenis. They have a very different dialect of Arabic, which makes it difficult for them to communicate with Lebanese folks sometimes or different Middle Eastern and Arabic speaking groups. And then also their skin is a little bit darker. And so there has been issues of colorism, even between the Arab American community, where Yemeni Americans are sort of looked down on and treated differently.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Brian Stone. He's English language editor for the Yemeni American News. In the past couple of weeks, as we mentioned, Yemeni Americans have been marching in Hamtramck in concert with the civil rights group Detroit Will Breathe. What were some of the concerns that the marchers wanted attention for?
Yeah. And so first of all, I have to give a shout out to our Yemeni American News reporter, Simon Albaugh, who did the report. And he did such a great job covering the protests. And one of the things that we're seeing evolve from the Black Lives Matter protest movement in general is not just the idea of sort of demilitarizing the police, but also demilitarizing the country, moving resources away from foreign wars into domestic needs within the African-American and minority communities. And one of the things that's an ongoing situation is that the United States continues to provide large sums of weaponry, bombs, missiles to Saudi Arabia, as well as aircraft and other equipment, which is then used in Yemen to bomb the civilian population. And so there is a real feeling within the Yemeni community that the United States could do more to create peace in the civil war situation. And that is where these two groups have really combined. Why spend money on bombs blowing up villages in Yemen when it could be spent building up communities here in the United States? And so these two groups really got together and found an affinity over this issue. And that's what the protests in Hamtramck were really about. It was about standing up for racial justice while standing up for justice for Yemenis here and abroad.
Is there anything in particular that we can say about Yemeni Americans as a voting bloc?
You know, Yemeni Americans are a bit more up for grabs between the two parties than most people really want to admit. Right now, with Donald Trump being president, I doubt we'll see very many Yemeni Americans voting Republican in the near future. But a lot of Yemeni Americans are successful business owners. They're very involved in medicine and science, engineering, and in IT fields. So there are a lot of Yemeni Americans that may be interested in a lower tax message or things like that. And so those are things where I don't think in the near future the Republican Party is going to have any kind of relationship with the Yemeni community. But over time, I think that opportunity is there. But for now, it's a really solidly Democratic community that I expect will be voting overwhelmingly Democratic. And that may or may not be why the post office in Hamtramck has had some machinery moved out.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Mayor Majewski in Hamtramck has been fighting on this issue alongside Representative Rashida Tlaib to try to get the equipment back. And, you know, Hamtramck is a tiny little town. It's, you know, there's a lot of people. It's an extremely dense city of about 30,000 persons, if I'm correct. You know, all of those individuals are living in a very small area, and it's primarily Bangladeshi, Polish, and Yemeni. And so these different minority communities are expected to vote Democratic. You know, many of them will be voting probably by mail in order to be safe in the pandemic. And there is a post office that many people walk to in Hamtramck. And so there's been a real concern about if this would be delayed because You know, the mail doesn't necessarily just go straight from that post office over. You know, it could cause issues with Yemeni Americans exercising their right to vote.
So many things are putting pressure on small newspapers right now. And I know that the Yemeni American News is called the Yemeni American News, but it's evident from reading your coverage that you guys get to a lot of different issues around Hamtramck and in the community. What's it been like, you know, becoming more of a paper of record while at the same time serving what the community wants to know?
You know, it has been a real joy because I feel like as a newspaper, we're bringing back local news to Dearborn and Hamtramck and bringing back the kind of quality local news, in some cases, investigative journalism, in-depth articles, and just following the city council meetings, following the school board meetings. All of that is the important work of local newspapers. And, you know, with corporate strip mining of some local papers and the receding of local reporters and others, we've really become the newspaper of record for Dearborn and Hamtramck. We're writing for all of the community. And that's reflected in our coverage as well. We've hired and brought on Bangladeshi reporters to write about different stories involving the Bangladeshi community. Obviously, my name's Brian Stone. I'm a white guy. I'm writing for the paper. Mm-hmm. So we're really just trying to do so much to make this a newspaper that is relevant and current for everyone and to bring back local journalism to these communities that need it so much. And it's a great thing that the Yemeni community gets to lead the way in this when it's needed so much.
Brian, just one more question. I wondered how the Yemeni community has been affected by the pandemic in the past few months.
Really, one of the things to understand is that both for Muslim Yemenis and just Yemenis of all stripes, community is so important. Summer is a time for weddings and big family events. And of course, you know, for many Muslim Yemenis, the mosque is a place of healing and solace and peace. You know, not being able to gather together and hear the chant of other people's voices during prayer, not being able to spend time with family. It's been really hard on the Yemeni community. You know, we've seen in America, families are getting generally smaller. Most families are having two or less kids. Whereas in the Yemeni community, it's still big. It's still boisterous and people want to get together. And so losing those bonds and connections, I think, has been particularly difficult during this pandemic. But to their credit, the mosques closed as soon as it was clear there was a pandemic, and they've really been a huge role in keeping the spread from happening. And so people are being responsible, but it's hard.
Brian Stone is English language editor for the Yemeni American News. Brian, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you.
What's getting us through this pandemic? To be honest, stress eating. And it's nice that we're finally getting to the time of year when that can involve fresh from the orchard Michigan apples. I gotta tell you, with my background in Oregon and Ohio, I have high expectations, and I am excited to get some fruit. In the weeks to come, we're going to drill down on some of the bounty that Michigan's orchards have to offer. And who better to start our tour than apple farmer and public radio professional extraordinaire Noah Ovshinsky. A longtime Michigander, he now comes to us from beautiful Madison, Wisconsin. First of all, are the Michigan and Wisconsin growing seasons simpatico enough that we can take you as a reliable source?
I am absolutely 100% a reliable source. I would say they are similar enough that, you know, many of the apples that you would find in Michigan, you find in Wisconsin and vice versa. And a lot of the growing practices and growing conditions are in the same, we'll call them the same universe.
Okay. So what apple do you have for us today?
Yeah, April. So my pick for today is Zestar for a few good reasons. It's really the first early season apple that, you know, has a crispy texture, has a sort of a tart sweet flavor to it. But it's one of those apples that kind of hints at those crisper apples that come to us later on in the season. You know, apples like Honeycrisp, Gala, and apples like that.
The University of Minnesota describes the Zestar varietal thusly, an exciting, zesty flavor with a hint of brown sugar. What do you think? Does that do it justice?
Yeah, I think that's about right. Again, you know, for an early season apple, it is exceptionally crisp. most of the apples that ripen in the upper Midwest in the sort of late August timeframe tend to be softer in texture, and Zestar is anything but. And so for people who like a really crisp eating apple, Zestar is it.
Does Zestar have a superhero origin story?
You know, it was brought to us by the geniuses at University of Minnesota who are dynamite breeders. You know, they gave us Honeycrisp, in fact. And so they are really good at breeding apples that people like. And, you know, beyond just the flavor and the texture, Zestar also, they size up nicely. So they're a good size apple. People feel like they're getting a good value for their dollar. They're also really good keepers if you store them in the fridge.
What tips do you have for us for tracking down Zestar or any other kinds of apples that we might be trying to find this year?
You know, Zestar is one of those apples that are openly grown, and any farmer can grow them if they choose. I think it was released in the market in the very late 90s, like early 2000s. Any person in the upper Midwest has a good shot at finding it at any sort of sizable orchard.
Noah Ovshinsky coming to us from Madison, Wisconsin. He's a longtime Michigander, now growing apples and producing public radio out of state. Noah, thank you so much for your time, and it's good to hear from you. We hope your family's doing well.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be here.
Next up, a pioneering musician who awakened millions of Americans to electronic music. We'll hear about a new biography of Wendy Carlos and meet the author in a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. In 1968, most Americans had never heard music played on a synthesizer. Most people would probably also have told you at the time that they didn't know anyone who was transgender. All that was about to change when Wendy Carlos released her debut album, Switched on Bach, a sleeper hit painstakingly recorded on the emerging technology devised by engineer Robert Moog. It reset the boundaries for composition and laid a path for millions of American musicians and composers who now have access to an exponentially larger range of sound. Despite her honors, a platinum record, a Grammy Award, and more, Wendy Carlos remains something of a cipher to her adoring public. And her story is told in the new biography, Wendy Carlos, written by Amanda Sewell, who joins us from the studios of Interlochen Public Radio, where she is music director. Amanda, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Thanks for having me.
What was your introduction to Wendy Carlos's music? Was it Switched on Bach?
Well, yes and no. Wendy Carlos has always been on my radar because we share a birthday. I got interested in Switched on Bach in particular, but all of her electronic Bach interpretations when I was a graduate student at Bowling Green State University. And I wrote about this album in terms of performance practice for both Baroque music and in terms of electronic music. And that's really where this got started.
One of her big claims to fame was that she was one of the first recording artists to really kind of make full use of what was at the time a really an evolving genre, synthesizers. Could you explain how synths, how they operated at that time?
Well, I don't know how much time we have allocated, so I won't get too technical, but I will say, not to sound like a curmudgeon, but kids these days have no idea what it used to be like to make electronic music. Each note had to be created individually. And I think it's hard for us to wrap our brains around now because we can just grab our phone or our tablet and open up various apps and get a pretty reasonable sounding violin or piano. But with these original analog synthesizers, each note required a different configuration of wires and buttons and switches to get the right pitch and the right timbre and the right frequency and the right attack and the right decay. It was just an incredible Venn diagram to get just one sound, record that sound, and then go on to the next sound. The Moog in particular was very temperamental and would go out of tune. So even if you wanted to return to the same violin playing C that you had before, it might have gone out of tune by then. So you had to redo the whole configuration again. And in Wendy Carlos's case, sometimes even hit the machine with a hammer to get it to go back in tune.
A big part of Wendy Carlos's professional story is her longtime working relationship with Robert Moog, the inventor, of course, of the Moog synthesizer and other instruments. But it sounds like they had kind of a prickly relationship. Could you explain how they got to know each other and be such close collaborators?
They met at a meeting of the Audio Engineering Society in the mid-1960s in New York. Bob Moog had gotten a spot there for free at the last minute and was able to show some of the prototypes of these analog synthesizers. Wendy Carlos was a graduate student at Columbia University at the same time, using these very, very, very large analog synthesizers in the laboratory there. And she was very interested in these smaller analog synths. And so they struck up a conversation. And as is the case with Wendy Carlos, she had a lot of feedback for him about improvements that could be made. And they worked together for a few years on the earliest versions.
How did Wendy Carlos come to record Bach's music for what was arguably her breakout record and the one that probably she's best known for, Switched on Bach? How did she settle on Bach?
She wanted to do an album of music on the Moog synthesizer to show people that the synthesizer could be approachable.
Let's take a listen for just a minute. This is Bach's Sinfonia to Cantata number 29, as interpreted by Wendy Carlos.
Up until the late 1960s, the synthesizer was largely something that you found in a very specialized laboratory at a university. And very often the music that those synthesizers were used to create was very, very abstract. And she wanted to bridge that gap and show people that the synthesizer could make music that was approachable. And she bounced a number of ideas off her longtime friend and collaborator and producer, Rachel Elkind. And Rachel suggested that she do an album of Bach's music, music that people already knew, but done in a completely different way. So that way there was at least something familiar for people to attach to. Rachel Elkind has said she thought this album would sell a few thousand copies, and she said she had no idea how wrong she was. The success of this album cannot be overstated.
Are you up for a short reading from the book?
Of course.
There's a passage about Switched on Bach that I wonder if you could deliver.
Sure. Listening to Switched on Bach creates a sort of auditory paradox. How can something be so mechanical and so human at the same time? It's motoric without seeming motorized. It's novel without being a cheap novelty. It's an abstraction without being abstract. Nobody could mistake the sounds of the Moog for those created with acoustic instruments, but the performances on this album cannot be dismissed as purely mechanical or automated. There are no abstract bleeps or chirps, no sense that the music is being spit out by some algorithm. Each individual note from Bach's scores was created and placed with such care that the collective result is richly nuanced and expressive. despite all of Carlos's concerns that the Moog's lack of a touch-sensitive keyboard was a detriment to her expressivity, the music of Switched on Bach is audibly human. Carlos did more than just feed another composer's notated music into a machine and record the sonic output. Carlos used Bach's score as if it were an architectural blueprint, but she created all of her construction and building materials from scratch.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amanda Sewell, the music director at Interlochen Public Radio and author of the new biography, Wendy Carlos. Amanda, this record, Switched on Bach, when it came out, became the best-selling classical record of its time. What did critics think of what Wendy Carlos was doing?
Well, they weren't quite sure what to think of it, but they knew it was a hit. I believe it was the critic for the New York Times who said if it wasn't a conflict of interest, he would buy up Moog stock. At the time, critics were just bowled over. I mean, everybody was. Even Sir George Schulte, who was the music director of the Chicago Symphony at the time, had something to say about the album. It was unprecedented. I mean, people had heard unusual interpretations of Bach in the 1960s. The Swingle Singers were out, and Glenn Gould had done some of his albums in his own unique Glenn Gould style, humming along and whatnot. But
right.
This particular interpretation of Bach just knocked everybody's socks off.
So Wendy Carlos, partly as a result of all this, caught the attention of the director Stanley Kubrick. And in subsequent years, they worked together on a score for a couple of films, including the one for A Clockwork Orange, which was really hard to forget. I still get chills when I hear some of those Bach treatments and other things that they worked on. How did the film work affect her fame and her career at that time?
Well, I think she and her work with the Moog were still household names. Well, the name that was a household name wasn't her name anymore at the time, we should say. But she has said of her work on A Clockwork Orange that Kubrick sort of got to have his cake and eat it too, because Stanley Kubrick is well known for having selected the music for his soundtracks very early in the production process. In fact, it's been well documented that even when filming, he would play excerpts of the scores that he wanted to have in those scenes in the final cut of the film. So with the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, in many cases, he had already chosen the classical music that he wanted to have, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Rossini overtures. But by having Carlos render those on the Moog synthesizer, he got that sort of futuristic sound that is really appropriate to the setting of A Clockwork Orange.
We haven't touched on something that's pretty central to Wendy Carlos's story to this point. When she was born, she was assigned a male gender and given the name Walter Carlos. And that was the identity that a lot of people knew her by for the first part of her career. As if contemporary composition weren't already an isolated space in the music world, here she was as a trans woman working in the field. How did she start to put together that she had been misidentified?
Well, it's one of those things where she knew from the beginning that she was female, but she was born in 1939. And in the 40s and 50s, there wasn't the language, there wasn't the cultural precedent for that. And so that led her to feel very, very isolated as well, that she knew her identity, but there wasn't anything for her to identify with. There wasn't a famous person, there wasn't any language for her to use to describe herself. And so she isolated herself for fear of being called a freak.
What were some of the ways in which the dysphoria that she felt affected what might have otherwise been happening in her career?
Well, she actually transitioned to female right when Switched on Bach came out. The problem was that she released this album that she thought, you know, a few people might buy, but she couldn't have anticipated it would sell 3 million copies and that people would be clamoring to talk to the creator of this album. But unfortunately, the name that appeared on that album belonged to a person who didn't really exist anymore. So she was caught in, do I tell people who I really am and risk the ridicule, the abuse that would come with that, or do I hide and pretend that this Walter Carlos person still exists and is just an aloof person who doesn't appear publicly? And so she hid from the public for over a decade after Switched on Bach came out because she didn't feel safe disclosing her transition.
She was probably one of the most famous Americans of her generation to undergo gender confirmation surgery. And she finally did go public in an article that was published in Playboy. Why did she decide that this was the place and the time that she wanted to ultimately talk about it?
Well, there were a couple of things happening in the broader culture. There were a few famous transgender people. Renee Richards, for example, had been very public in the 1970s, arguing that she should be able to play tennis. The composer and producer and arranger, Angela Morley, who worked closely with John Williams for many years, she's also transgender, and she was nominated for Academy Awards for her work. So there were trans women who were known publicly. And the other thing is, Wendy Carlos was just sick of hiding. She was sick of having this double life. She wanted to be out there talking about her music, and she needed to do that as herself. She had her final Bach album coming up, The Switched on Brandenburgs, which was sort of the final chapter in her synthesized Bach at the time. And she wanted to be able to talk about it and get out there. And so I think she finally decided that she was ready to disclose who she actually was.
How was that information received that she was a trans woman?
Well, I think a lot of people were just delighted to know that this musician was actually still alive and still making music, first of all. It's an interesting cultural barometer. A lot of people I talk to now, they remember not only when Switch on Bach came out, but also when Wendy Carlos disclosed her transition. And those are very notable cultural moments for people. She was the first trans person that a lot of people had known by one name and then by another. There was definitely ugliness around it. Even now, a trans person can't exist without having ugly things said about them. But I will say that I looked at a number of the letters to the editor that were written to Playboy following her interview, and I'm sure they didn't keep all of the negative ones, but there were so many written saying, you know, this was a fascinating interview. I didn't know anything about these kind of people, quote unquote, beforehand. And thank you for showing me that, you know, this woman is intelligent and sensitive and that these people aren't freaks. She didn't want to be a spokesperson for all transgender people, but in a way, because she was one of the first people to disclose her transition publicly, she ended up having that role.
Wendy Carlos's innovations would have been historic, even if she wouldn't have been a trans woman. I mean, this was just the dawn of electronic music in so many ways. Do you think that she would have been the musician she was if maybe her life had gone differently, if she'd presented as heteronormative?
I mean, it's hard to tell. I think she would have been able to be more public from the beginning. And yet, you know, it's hard to speculate. She can be challenging. She has a lot of opinions and states them very forcefully. If she had been doing that from the beginning, I don't know if it would have been easy to collaborate with her, even if she was available and not hiding in her house. There's a great story. She has said that Stevie Wonder came to her house in 1969 or 1970 and wanted to meet the creator of Switched on Bach, who he thought was Walter Carlos, and she hid from him and wouldn't speak to him because she said, I knew as soon as I talked, he would know my secret. And so
Wow. One
can only imagine what would happen if Wendy Carlos and Stevie Wonder had been able to collaborate.
Amanda Sewell is the author of the new biography, Wendy Carlos, which publishes on September 2nd. Amanda, the book is just fascinating. Thank you so much for all the research you put into it and for talking to us.
Thank you, April.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. That's it for Stateside today. I'm April Baer. Good to have you with us. We'll see you tomorrow.